Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, should the United States go through with the White House's plan to withdraw from the Paris Agreement on climate change? And if so, what would be the justification? Would following the principles of the Paris Agreement put the U.S. at an economic disadvantage? Are the terms of the climate pact unfair to the U.S. for other reasons? Or should the United States return to the agreement and help fulfill its terms? Hello, I'm Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Carol Castiel. The Paris Agreement, which entered into force in November 2016 after ratification by 55 countries, that together accounted for 55% of total global emissions. By early 2017, 125 nations said yes to the Paris Agreement. The pact sets a goal of limiting the global temperature increase to below 2 degrees Celsius, referenced against the pre-industrial age, with 1.5 degrees being the optimum target. The pact sets forth that developed nations, such as the United States, set peak emissions limits and then work to reduce that level with absolute economy-wide reduction targets, while developing countries are encouraged to move towards such reduction targets over time. The Paris Agreement contains a series of protocols for both developed and developing nations to follow in their effort to eventually achieve limits on greenhouse gas emissions and beyond that, their reduction. In August 2017, the Trump White House announced that the United States will withdraw from the Paris Agreement, asserting that the climate pact, while putting strict limits on the U.S. and other developed nations, held China, India, and other nations deemed developing to less strict greenhouse gas emissions. Joining me on Encounter today are two analysts with different perspectives on the agreement. They are Jordan McGillis, a policy analyst with the energy research group American Energy Alliance in Washington, which opposes the Paris Agreement. Also based in Washington and a Paris Agreement supporter is Natural Resources Defense Council Energy Policy Manager Han Chen. Let's define the sides in this discussion. First, Mr. McGillis, please explain the American Energy Alliance's reasons for opposing the Paris Agreement.
Our position at the American Energy Alliance is first and foremost that affordable energy is an indispensable component of human well-being, particularly when we face challenges such as we may from climate change. A second element of our argument is that public policy can provide us with trade-offs. It can't provide us with solutions. The Paris Agreement is being bandied about as a solution, and it certainly isn't that. And you don't have to take my word for it. James Hansen, a leading climate scientist and activist, describes it as a fraud. This agreement does very little to actually stem greenhouse gas emissions over the long term. It isn't a good deal for the American people. And more importantly, it's not an appropriate response to the challenges we face, which is instead free market adaptation.
Ms. Chen, why don't you detail why the Natural Resources Defense Council supports and defends the Paris Agreement?
The reason that we and the majority of Americans support staying in the Paris Agreement, in fact, 7 out of 10 Americans supported, according to polling by the Chicago Council of Global Affairs, is because the challenge we're facing is really clear. We've spent $300 billion because of climate and weather-related disasters in 2017 alone. And what the Paris Agreement does is it allows countries to put forward nationally determined contributions of how each country will reduce their emissions. And it also lets us hold other countries accountable. So whether that's China or India, we put forward our targets, our commitments. Other countries put forward their targets and commitments. So we can see in the overall scheme of things, how much are we reducing emissions? And before Paris, we were looking at a world where temperature increases were going to be over 5 degrees Celsius. After the Paris Agreement and the commitments, we're down to a 3 degrees Celsius world. And we need to do more, not less, to get to a 2 degree and eventually a 1.5 degree world.
There's a lot of complications to the Paris Agreement. And just so everyone who's listening has a clear idea, when we're talking about 2 degrees Celsius reduction, from what I understood from reading this, this is a reduction trying to get back to pre-industrial levels. We're getting into the weeds here, but we need a bit of a clarity so that we can properly convey the information here to people who are listening to the show. What are we talking about in temperature target terms here? Let's explain this.
Well, it's not a reduction, as you just said. We're talking about limiting a rise. We're on pace right now to eclipse 3 degrees of warming, according to the IPCC, under most projections. The Paris Agreement aims to limit the rise to 2 degrees of Celsius warming, and that's from pre-industrial levels.
I think what people may forget is that we're already at about 1 degree Celsius of warming. This is what has already happened compared to pre-industrial levels. So we're trying to make sure that we limit to 2 degrees and we make the best effort to try to limit to 1.5, because the impacts at 1.5 are already quite severe. And the most vulnerable countries, island states that are going to be flooded, they are pushing for 1.5 degrees because the stakes for them are very high.
Something that I'd like to emphasize is that though we do face challenges and undoubtedly costs in the long run from a warming world, public policies have costs as well. So what we're looking at here are trade-offs. And if you look at the leading climate economics research, such as from William Nordhaus, who has recently awarded the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics, what we're told is that a 1.5 degree warming scenario is actually much more harmful for our economic scenario than allowing temperatures to rise more and having more economic growth and wealth maximization. According to Nordhaus, we're actually better off if we have about 3 degrees of warming rather than this 1.5 rather arbitrarily set limit that the IPCC is suggesting.
If you look at the national climate assessment done by the United States, by the government, you'll see that at a track where we get to 4 degrees Celsius of warming versus a track where you get to 2 degrees Celsius, the difference is billions of dollars in economic costs. So that's lost labor days because of extreme heat. That's mortality related to extreme heat. There's a huge variety of costs for businesses, for our health, because of climate change. And so the more that we can do to limit that, the better for everyone in our cities and our communities.
And my organization and me personally, I take a very different view. I don't think that government's role is to assess long-term economic harm and then mete out a centralized solution. What I want is economic freedom to give people the opportunity to adapt to these changes in the best way they see fit. The more we can maximize wealth, the better we are at dealing with all challenges. And if you look at the last 100 years of data on mortality from natural disaster-related events such as tornadoes, floods, hurricanes, they've massively declined, and that's because we're much wealthier.
How would you respond to people who would say very cynically, you support market-based solutions? They would say, in contrast to that, if you say, let's let the marketplace determine how this is going to be resolved. Some would say very cynically, the market isn't going to try to resolve this. The market is always looking for the cheapest possible solution. If the market can get away with burning, for instance, coal and not having emission scrubbers on the stacks, etc., then that's where the market is going to go. Now, I'm just bringing this up as a contrarian point, and I want to see if you are faced with someone who brings up this cynical point, how do you respond to it?
Well, I'm faced with that quite often, as a matter of fact. And my response, again, is that public policy is not about solutions, it's about trade-offs. So the market is not moving in any particular direction. What the market is individuals and firms making choices on their profit margins and on their long-term interest. Public policy can't determine how a society should view damages 100 years from now. That's a choice that individuals and firms can make, though, and can bear risk relative to how they assess those things. So I want individuals and firms to be making their own decisions based on how they interpret this information that we're getting from groups such as the IPCC.
I'm not taking an ideological, philosophical approach to this. I'm looking at the data of what's happened over the last 40 years. So since 1980, we've had hundreds of climate and weather events that have been each one over $1 billion in damage. The cost has been over $1.6 trillion. And so what do Americans want? They want us to actually do something about climate disaster and the risks that we're increasing by allowing fossil fuels to keep being burned. And so it is true that in the market, if there is no regulation, if there is no policy to guide decisions toward cleaner energy, away from highly polluting sources of energy, then we're going to end up with more and more climate disasters. And I don't treat this as an ideological question. I treat this as a fact. I mean, I'm from Florida. I grew up in Tampa. And when people and my friends tell me that they're buying houses now, the first thing I think about is how close are they to the coast? Because the premiums for flood insurance down there, it's already reaching tens of thousands of dollars in some cases, because insurance actuaries, they're not treating this as an ideological question. It's a practical reality that the risks from climate change are very severe.
Mr. McGillis, what do you think?
I agree largely with what Han just said regarding insurance and actuarial science responding to this information. That's exactly what a market does. It looks at all the information available, and it makes decisions based on risk accordingly. So we're already seeing people make choices incorporating this information. What I anticipate will occur over the course of the remainder of this century is that people will become more aware of the challenges we face, and they will act accordingly. Something that we could do politically, though, to make that an even more seamless process is reform our subsidies for flood insurance. That's something that's putting people into floodplains when they should be doing just the opposite.
On the subsidies question, if I can also point out that the U.S. has provided billions of dollars in subsidies for fossil fuels, right? You have states, federal level subsidies for drilling and other things. And the problem with that is that's not really a market solution either, right? So we've been subsidizing the damage to the climate for decades. These are permanent tax subsidies. They're not ones that expire like for wind and solar credits. Mm-hmm. So this type of damage is something that we've actually been subsidizing, and that's not a market solution at all.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Today's discussion is on the Paris Agreement on climate change and whether the United States is right to go through with its stated intent to withdraw from the pact. My guests for this discussion are American Energy Alliance analyst Jordan McGillis, which opposes the Paris Agreement. And on the other side of this discussion is the environmental advocacy group Natural Resources Defense Council and their analyst Han Chen. If you like podcasts, you can get Encounter on a free download through iTunes. You can find that download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/encounter. You can also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or come join us on Facebook. In fact, here's a big shout out for one of our listeners, Bashir Madi from Yola, Nigeria, who's one of our Facebook fans. If you want to hear your own name and country on this program, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or on Facebook, give us a like and leave a comment. Let's get back into the Paris Agreement and the announced U.S. pullout. The House of Representatives, one half of the U.S. Congress, has passed a measure, H.R. 9, which is called the Climate Action Now Act. It would block U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Agreement. While this measure has passed the House of Representatives, it now sits with the U.S. Senate, which is controlled by a different party, as is the White House. And because of that, the Climate Action Now Act is not expected to gain Senate approval. My question to both of my guests is whether the House's action and the Senate's expected response is deemed as partisan or as a reflection of the merits of the particulars of the Paris Agreement. Ms. Chen, what do you think?
The fact that the House has voted and passed Climate Action Now means that for the first time in almost a decade, we've got a real commitment from the House to take climate action. It means we're fulfilling our commitment to the world, to public health and here in the U.S., to protecting our communities that are facing climate disaster, and to also making sure that the U.S. is competitive when it comes to clean energy around the world. So, you know, we have 3.3 million people employed in clean energy in the U.S., in efficiency, EVs, electric vehicles. And the reason that 228 Democrats and 3 Republicans supported the passage of this is because we can't do nothing. We can't withdraw from the Paris Agreement and then move backwards the way that the current administration is taking us. And so what this agreement says is within 120 days, the president has to lay out a plan for actually reducing our emissions 26% to 28% by 2025. From the 2005 levels. And it's also the president's job to make sure that we're using the Paris Agreement and the tools for transparency within it to hold other countries accountable for their emissions as well. And that's something that I think both parties should be able to support.
What are your thoughts on H.R. 9, Mr. McGillis?
Han made an interesting remark earlier when she commented on the 7 out of 10 Americans that support the United States remaining in the Paris Agreement. I haven't seen that particular statistic, but it doesn't surprise me. Americans, by and large, do support this sort of endeavor until they see what that actually entails. Another element of this discussion is democratic legitimacy. If indeed 7/10 of Americans support being in this deal, it may have made sense for the president who initiated this program, Barack Obama, to send this international agreement to the Senate for ratification. Instead, he chose to sign it as an executive order, which opened the door for Donald Trump to withdraw from the agreement. So what we have here is a situation in which the Democratic president was actually the one who spurned the democratic process on this policy. Had he chosen, Obama could have sent the agreement to the Senate for ratification. He chose not to do that, and thus Donald Trump had the option to withdraw.
The U.S. has been part of the U.N. Framework Convention on Climate Change since the early 1990s. And what the Paris Agreement is a continuation of the Framework Convention on Climate Change that, you know, lays out the type of reporting requirements that the U.S. already agreed to when we ratified the U.N. Framework Convention on Climate Change. So it is now up to the president to, you know, put forward this NDC on behalf of the United States and to, you know, hold other countries accountable for their NDCs and their climate targets as well through the Paris Agreement. But we already agreed in that earlier agreement, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, that the U.S. would take on this role, that the U.S. would take part in this international agreement.
Now, an interesting point in terms of holding other states accountable here. The agreement ostensibly is meant to limit the rise in temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius. However, the pledges, if you actually take a cumulative estimate of what they would do, we're still looking at 3 degrees Celsius of temperature increase. So how much accountability actually do we have here? Now, what the United States chose to do is say, we simply do not want to comply with the executive order of a previous administration. The United States is actually reducing its emissions, and that's primarily as a result of the fracking and shale revolution. Our greenhouse gas emissions have dropped by 10% since 2005.
Would it be too cynical at all to bring up the idea that President Obama did this as an executive order because he was facing both a House of Representatives and a Senate that were in the hands of the opposite party, and therefore he did not expect this to be able to get any traction whatsoever in Congress, and therefore his only option was using an executive order? Is that too cynical?
I think so. I think that's a bit cynical because I think what we created in Paris, which was different from the Kyoto Protocol, which was not approved by the U.S., is a system where countries do have that self-directed way of setting their targets. So countries put forward a target. I'm going to do the basic math here on this, which is to say if we were on a path to a 5C world, 5 degrees of warming before Paris, and now we're on track for 3, that is a huge improvement. So it's not reaching the target that's set in Paris, which is 2 with an effort to reach 1.5, but it has reduced the emissions trajectory of the planet. And this is extremely important because looking at this question of domestic emissions, they've actually gone up in the U.S. in the past year, so they haven't completely gone down. So these are all decisions that we have to make domestically that have a huge impact on the world. The U.S. is one of the largest polluters in the world and the largest historical contributor to climate change.
One thing that I think needs to be brought up in this discussion, and I need the help of both of you to do this, how is it possible to reduce emissions and work towards a lowering of the rise in temperature? Now, let's explain. What would be the mechanisms for doing that?
First, I'd like to challenge the unstated premise of that question, which is that that's a goal that our government should have. I disagree. My view is that if we look at this data from IPCC, we can incorporate it into our decisions in the market. If you look at one of the worst case scenarios presented, which is called RCP 8.5, we're looking at about 1 meter of sea level rise in the year 2100. What that means is we're facing only about a centimeter of sea level rise each year. In my estimation, that's something that can easily be accommodated by the market. When we talk in abstract terms or even about temperature figures, we often overlook what that actually means for people on the ground who are dealing with these changes. And something that is concrete is that sea level rise. And even in the worst case scenario, the RCP 8.5, it's only going to be about a meter, according to the central estimate, in the year 2100.
I did not propose that this be government intervention or government control. My question simply was, what can we do that lowers emissions and lowers greenhouse gases, that reduces the effects of temperature rise caused by too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? How do we do this?
Sure.
That's what the question is.
So to directly answer that question about the technologies and methods, what we want to do is to switch from dirty, polluting fossil fuels to cleaner alternatives that are already working today. So in the U.S., in China, and India, we have hundreds of gigawatts of solar panels and wind capacity. And those are big sort of technical numbers, you know, 100 gigawatts here and there. But if you look at what the U.S. has built in terms of solar, there's 64 gigawatts, and that's enough to power 12.3 million U.S. homes. So that's a concrete example of progress that's already been made across the U.S. in terms of wind capacity. You know, we are second after China. We're before Germany. India is the world's fifth biggest market already for wind. So if you look around the world, this isn't really just an ideological question. It's a practical economic reality that when you count the cost of fossil fuels, whether that's the pollution, whether that's the climate impact, health impacts, they're dirty, and the market doesn't price these things in. So we need to have policies that say, hey, if you pollute the air, if you cause lung cancer, if you contribute to water pollution, these are not technologies we should be using. We should be using solar, we should be using wind, we should be using storage. And, you know, gas is also polluting. So even as the U.S. is shifting away from coal, we need to make sure that the U.S. is shifting towards renewable energy and not away towards gas.
I'd like to draw an important distinction between the two views being presented here. One is lumping together localized air pollution with climate change. My view, on the other hand, distinguishes between those two, and that's what the Paris Agreement does. The Paris Agreement focuses on climate change caused by greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases are not local air pollutants, so describing them as dirty in this context doesn't quite make sense. We're talking about a global climate agreement, not localized air pollution, which has different solutions.
Well, and I think the one distinction there is actually that if you read the full text of the Paris Agreement, it's about making sure that development also takes the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals developed by the UN, into account. So that does mean you not only care about climate, you make sure that there's co-benefits in terms of air pollution, in terms of health. All of these things have to be thought of together, because we're talking about a world where there's lots of people who don't have electricity yet. And so how do they develop? How do they determine the energy future that they want? It's about having cleaner air locally, and it's about making sure that the solutions are good for the climate globally.
I want to bring up something, though, that goes straight back to the White House. When it was announced that the U.S. was going to pull out of the Paris Agreement, one of the things that was said in the course of that announcement is, well, why is it that countries like the United States are held by this agreement to these very strict limits? And you have a country like China, which is allowed to pollute on a much higher level, and it is not held to the same standards. It is not compelled to reduce at the same standards. And people in this point of view would say, look at China. China is at this point the second largest economy in the world. It is a highly developed country. It is extremely advanced, but they're using the term developing as an umbrella to exceed targets or limits that are being imposed on other countries. I want to get your response, both of you, to this idea that some countries get a better deal than other countries. Is that a fair assessment of the Paris Agreement, or am I being improper in the way I'm looking at this?
Given the tenor of the White House's orientation toward China in particular, is it surprising that that's the view that the White House would present? Frankly, I think it's a rather unsophisticated description of the situation, because what actually matters in terms of justice is per capita emissions. If you consider emissions to be a cost that you're imposing on others, as Han does, or as some sort of infringement, then we would want to look at per capita rather than a cumulative amount from a country. My view is that we're all part of an integrated global economy, and it doesn't make sense to hinder the growth of any country in particular. But to get to the specifics, China's commitment is quite minimal. It's simply that they will peak their emissions by year 2030, whereas we are expected to drop our emissions by about a quarter in the next 6 years.
There's a lot of distinctions that need to be made here, which is that if you look at the best global estimates and experts looking at each country's nationally determined contribution and evaluating them, the U.S.'s commitments right now put the world on a 4 to 5 degree track. We're just not ambitious enough. If you look at what the Chinese are doing, it would put the world on a 2 to 3 degree track. So there's actually more that China needs to do, but they're clearly a little more ambitious than what the U.S. is doing right now. And in India, they're closest to a 1.5, 2-degree track with the commitments that they've made. And this is accounting for per capita emissions, current development level, so on. And when you look at China, emissions per person in China are half of what they are in the U.S. Emissions in India are 8.5 times lower than what they are in the U.S. So we are all coming from different starting points. But the fact is, China and India are going to have to develop in a way that requires them to really bend the curve on emissions.
One thing is on the table in agreement. The Earth indeed is getting warmer, and that warming has effects. My guests have been Jordan McGillis with the Washington-based energy research group, the American Energy Alliance, and the environmental group National Resources Defense Council, Han Chin, also based in Washington. Sitting in for Encounters host Carol Castiel, this is VOA Africa Division Senior Analyst Jeffrey Young. Join us next week for another edition of VOA Encounter.